your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
And that's me. Thank you so much for listening in today. Special thanks and a shout out to those folks on Levinson's 94.7. Let me also thank the Wolf Trap for supporting WNRN, Wolf Trap National Park, and their performing arts, bringing you Lucinda Williams and Amos Lee together for one night on Tuesday, July 19th at 8 p.m. You can find tickets on sale at wolftrap.org or dial them 877-WOLF-TRAP. That's Lucinda Williams and Amos Lee at Wolf Trap, where the arts come out to play. All right, a wake-up call on air at the moment with our guest today, David Hanna. Conversation. We will have lots of conversation today, but he's also the conservation director at Wild Virginia. David, how are you?
I'm fine this morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for stumbling in on a beautiful Sunday morning.
It is.
Wild Virginia is a nonprofit conservation organization. I can tell that's going to trip me up all hour. Conservation organization. David, I had never heard of Wild Virginia until I saw an op-ed piece, or whatever the proper term is, in a Daily Progress a month or two ago. How does Wild Virginia compare to some of the other conservation groups that people are more familiar with?
Well, we are smaller, as you might imagine, since you have not heard of us until recently. We've been around, though, since 1995. Our headquarters are in Charlottesville, but we have a membership from around the state. So we have, I like to think, sort of a loyal following of people who are interested in what we do and interested in national forest issues that kind of run with us. We are not as large, and so I guess do not make our presence as widely felt as other organizations. We are strictly local in that we work only in national forests in Virginia. So we're not a national group or even a regional group from that perspective.
All right. We're going to talk about a variety of things during the hour today. We're going to talk about the George Washington National Forest, which is a big part of what Wild Virginia does, and some of the, I guess, federal conversations that are being had on what to do in the coming years with the George Washington National Forest, some decisions that need to be made, and how to do them that, I guess, benefits a variety of people. So write the numbers down, dial us up, 979-0919. George Washington National Forest reaches out for 1 million acres. Is that correct?
That's right. It's the largest national forest in the eastern United States, and I feel very lucky to live in Virginia and to have it in our backyard. Basically, as I talk to people about conservation, I guess we're having a conversation about conservation this morning. I'm really surprised and struck that so few people are aware of the National Forest and the George Washington National Forest. Everyone seems to know about Shenandoah National Park or a local county park or that sort of thing, but the George Washington is a huge resource. It is over 1 million acres in size. A little bit of it runs into West Virginia, but more than 90% of it is in Virginia. So it's a huge natural resource that and our Wild Virginia's focus is that it should be managed wisely and appropriately for the long term. That is basically our reason to be.
So we will be talking about the George Washington National Forest. And one of the things that I guess sort of caught me off guard when doing my homework for the show is not just let's save the bike trails, let's, you know, make sure that people can go out and do their thing and have their fun. But also we're going to be talking about logging and, I guess, some gas and oil issues. And it seems to cover a variety of uses, which I wasn't prepared for.
Yes. As I talk to folks around the state, a lot of people are very surprised to learn that things like timber harvest, hunting and fishing, oil and gas extraction, road construction. Those kinds of activities take place on our national forests, but they do, not only in Virginia, but across the country in all the national forests. There was a legislation in 1960, the Multiple Use and Sustainable Yield Act, and it calls for multiple use of these lands. And so that's a phrase you hear a lot, multiple use. It is very much unlike national parks, like the Shenandoah National Park, where there is no extractive activity allowed. The emphasis is on recreation and conserving biological diversity and wildlife habitat as sort of a shortcut for that. So very, very different management philosophy from national parks and some other national or natural areas that people might be familiar with.
And I'm going to get into that in just a moment, what the difference is in a little lengthier conversation. But 11:06 here on the Wake Up Call as we talk with David Hanna, who's the, I think I even wrote typed this improperly. I have conservation director in my head, and I know that's what it is, not conversation. But today it is the conversation director, conservation director of Wild Virginia, which is an organization here located in Charlottesville, a nonprofit organization, and we'll be spending a lot of time talking about the George Washington National Forest. But David, the U.S. Forest Service, which is a group that you work with, what do they do? I mean, the image that I think many people have, or at least that I have, is this group with their uniforms on and their Smokey Bear hats doing their thing to make sure that people preserve the lands properly. But I know that there's more to it than that.
Yeah, there's much more to it than that. I guess you're right. The image a lot of people have is of a forest ranger in uniform trying to prevent forest fires and also creating timber or logging timber for use in our economy. But there is much, much more to that if you think about how land should be managed holistically for the health of the forest, for the health of the land, for water quality, for air quality. There's much, much more to it than simply trying to prevent forest fires, which could be another topic altogether, whether preventing forest fires is a good thing or not, and providing timber to local communities.
But, I mean, there's more to it. I think both of us have said that now. It's not just preventing the fires, because if it's a federal group, we know that there are administration offices, and there's more than just a handful of people in Washington, D.C. deciding who gets hired, who gets fired, and what the new color of the 2012 uniform is going to be.
Right. Just a few numbers to toss out at you. There are 155 national forests around the country.
155 national forests.
Yes.
Again, in a minute I'm going to ask you to define that or to a little more about national forest versus national park. 155 national forests.
That's right. And almost, well, right at 190 million acres that they manage, that the U.S. Forest Service manages. And they also have another type of unit, national grasslands. So in the Midwest, there are 20 national grasslands, another 4 million acres that the U.S. Forest Service also manages. So they certainly have a large plate, a lot of things to do. And again, it is not just, as you were saying, fire prevention and timber harvest. I mentioned water quality. Our national forests are tremendous resources and should be protectors of water quality. The George Washington National Forest, for instance, there are 22 local communities just outside, just on the border of the national forest that get their drinking water, at least in part, from the surface waters of the national forest. Almost half of the national forest land in Virginia is in one of these local drinking watersheds. So that's a tremendous responsibility, really, to manage the forest well, to produce good quality water for people to use in their homes.
Again, David Hanna here from the Wild Virginia nonprofit organization as we talk about the George Washington National Forest, the focus of the hour, but also the national forests as a group and exactly what that does. Do you know what the annual budget is for this? A lot of the conversation around the United States these days is about the huge deficit. If one group says that we're not going to increase taxes – then as a nation, that means we need to trim our spending. How much are we spending with the U.S. Forest Service?
Yeah. The budget numbers are not something I usually track very closely, but in fiscal year 2011, the budget for the Forest Service is $5.3 billion. So that $5.3 billion is to manage all of these 194 million acres of land and 159 units that they do manage. The budget for next year, President Obama is recommending a slight decrease in that number. I think it will go down to $5.1 billion next year if his budget would pass, which, of course, we don't know what will happen with that. But the Forest Service, just like every federal agency, is trying to do more work with less money as each year goes by. The George Washington's headquarters are in Roanoke, and the headquarters are both for the Jefferson National Forest, which is in southwestern Virginia, and the George Washington, which is more western Virginia. But over the years, the office for each of those forests was combined into one office. Some of the ranger districts on the National Forest have combined offices. The Glenwood and Peddler ranger districts were combined several years ago into one office. The Dry River and the Deerfield Ranger District were combined into the North River District a few years ago. So again, this trying to do more and more with less funding, which is a theme for many, many people, not just federal agencies, but it certainly is one of the things for the Forest Service and one of the challenges in managing and putting together a good management plan for the George Washington.
Well, let's talk about Wild Virginia. Again, a nonprofit organization working on conservation of the specific, or not only, but currently mainly of the George Washington National Forest. Where do you get your money from, and what do you do with it?
Sure. We are a membership organization, so we have roughly about 500 members right now statewide. So our membership and membership dues represent about 15% of our annual income. The other 85% is mostly from grants that we get from environmental foundations. So we, like many other nonprofits, compete for shrinking dollars that are available for conservation work. We do hold fundraising events from time to time, maybe one per year. This past year, and the past 2 years, actually, we had the Wild and Scenic Film Festival in Charlottesville and Stanton. Not as big a fundraising event as sort of a membership and a raising awareness event about conservation in general and our work. Those have been a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun this past year at the Paramount Theater putting that on, and at the Visual Light in Stanton. So great films that really drive home some conservation themes. And it's a good way for us to interact with our members and for people to get to know us. In years past, we've had an annual party, for two years running, we had what we called the Tree Huggers Ball, which was a dance and music and get together and fun food and fun evening as a fundraising event. So,
let me jump in here real quick. Is Wild Virginia happy with what you've been able to accomplish, and are you happy with what the Forest Service and their decisions that they're making? Because that's something we need to get into, is the decisions that are being made or have been brought forth as possible decisions in something that's ongoing now.
Right. We are very happy with the work that we've been doing. We historically, in the past, we've done a lot more of what we called Forest Watch work, which was to monitor projects on the National Forest, timber sales or new roads, whatever project might come down the pike. We would monitor to make sure that we were that was an appropriate project. It didn't wasn't too hard or on the land. So we spent a lot of time, a lot of resources on that sort of work. We still do that. We still monitor each and every project that is proposed on the National Forest, but we are more selective in the ones that we tend to pay a lot of attention to and work with in detail. We spend more time these days on education and outreach. I love to come talk to groups about our work and tell folks about the National Forest and some of the management issues there, which I know we will be talking about more as the morning wears on. But we've also done several projects in the last year. One we completed 2 years ago was about drinking water resources in the national forest. So we completed this study, which documented some of the numbers I tossed out a minute ago, about 22 local communities relying on the national forest for drinking water, more than 250,000 people. And those are just citizens. Those are residents. That doesn't include hospitals, schools, agricultural use, or businesses.
Does or does not include them?
Does not include them. So that 250,000 people is a very, very conservative number. And those, again, are just local communities. The National Forest is also headwaters for the Shenandoah and Potomac Rivers, which flow through Washington, D.C. So more than 1 million people in Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C. draw their water, drinking water, from the Potomac. The headwaters for the James are also located in the National Forest, James River flowing through Richmond, Virginia, and I don't know the number, but lots of people in the Richmond area drawing water from the James River. So a lot of implication for clean water needs coming off the National Forest. So we were very proud of that study, and in fact, working with some of our conservation partners and getting the word out about our findings, 40 different organizations adopted resolutions calling on the Forest Service to do a better job, a stronger job of protecting drinking water resources on the National Forest. And 40 of those organizations are actually local governments, city councils, town councils, or county boards of supervisors. So we feel real good about that project. Just this past year, we did a study about another threat to the forest, and not just the forest, but all natural areas, that is invasive plants. So we hired a couple of field workers last year who walked about 29 miles of trails and streams in the Ramsey's Draft Wilderness area in the National Forest in the George Washington, and documented the non-native plants that they saw. And that was really the first survey of that type that had been done in a wilderness area in the George Washington. And we did find that they certainly are a presence. We found five species in the wilderness area itself, but many other species on the outskirts, on the borders of the wilderness area.
And why is that a problem?
Well, non-native plants can displace native plants, so they can outcompete. And
but it's a forest, so having plants, I mean, is what's there. That's what's supposed to be there, right? Not people. So, still a good thing, right?
Well, the forests are for people. The forests are not to be isolated and not to be used. At least that's our perspective, that the forest has lots of users, whether it be backpackers, campers, hunters, fishermen, mountain bike riders, horseback riders. There's a lot of users of the forest, and that's as it should be. But the plants I'm referring to are plants that have been brought here from other continents in many cases and have become ensconced in the landscape and do take over or outcompete native plants in many cases, and so can disrupt wildlife habitat, can disrupt natural communities. They sometimes can threaten the presence of rare plants in the forest. So we do believe that some effort should be made to minimize the impacts of non-native plants in the national forest. It is a huge ecological issue. Lots and lots of people are becoming more aware of it all the time. So the National Forest, plus other places like Shenandoah National Park, Ivy Creek Natural Area here in Charlottesville, the non-native plants are just a tremendous presence across the landscape. So it's a huge issue, and we want to try to get the National Forest engaged and involved in that.
11:19 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, David Hanna. He's the conservation director for Wild Virginia, which is a local nonprofit organization. Let me give you the markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Sunny today, high about 90, in the valley only in the upper 80s. Clear tonight, lows in the upper 60s. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 90 to 95. Right now, it's a beautiful day outside. 79 in the valley, 82 in Lynchburg, 85 in Richmond, 84 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today, where you are encouraged to be kind, have fun, and do the right thing. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is found at Barracks Road in Charlottesville, three locations in Richmond, online, brms.com. Let me also thank L. Oppelman's Central Virginia's Complete Music Headquarters, continuously operated since 1890 at 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. L. Oppelman's Music Department now featuring acoustic guitars, banjos, mandolins, and violins, as well as electric guitar packages. Also available, complete drum sets, L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street, Lynchburg, and at loppelman.com. And let me also thank those folks around Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley by giving you a unique mix of favorite music and new artists that you won't hear anywhere else, in addition to giving you opportunities to win everything from CDs to concert tickets and nights on the town. We can only do that with the support of R.K. Armazani, Gene McCusker, and my mom, who supported us during the last fund drive. You can become a part of community radio at its best and show your support by taking a donation to WNRN in the next fund drive or anytime at WNRN.org. All right, back with our guest today, David Hanna. And we're going to start with a phone call from Michelle, my friend Michelle. Hey, Michelle.
Hey, Rick.
You got a question or a comment on the topic with David?
Oh, yeah. first of all, another great topic you're bringing us here, and I just want to check real quick in the beginning. Mr. David Hanna, welcome, and let's rule out or not, are you related to Jack Hanna?
Well, thank you, Michelle. No, I'm not, at least not that I know of.
Okay, well, that was the trivial question. a suggestion. You alluded to a tree hugger's ball, and as cute as that name sounds, and it grabs people, I would suggest that there are a lot of people that will be quick to brush it aside as, oh, those tree huggers, and you might want to consider another name, you know, to bring a bit more credibility. And I know I'm speaking, you know, out of place here, but something like Nature Lover's Ball or Promote Nature, something that wouldn't give them ammunition to, you know, berate your effort. Moving on past that, could you please give us a website for the invasive plant list? And here's my main question. How about a brief update on a topic that Rick actually had a guy on before that talked about uranium mining in Virginia? And I'd like to know if you have an update on that. I just saw recently that Tim Kaine is in favor of exploring more about that. And apparently, you know, we have a big deposit of it here in Virginia, and everybody's dying to get their hands on it. But, you know, it, you know, would destroy the landscape and pollute the water and so on. So the invasive plants website and a brief update on what's going on with uranium mining. And thanks for being there.
Hey, thanks, Michelle.
Well, thank you, Michelle. That's a lot of information packed into your questions. Yeah, the tree hugger's ball, I take your comment. We haven't had that for 3 years now. We've moved on to the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, which I think is a better fit. We actually co-produced the tree hugger's ball with another organization in town, and it is kind of a retro name. Anyone who talks to us, I think, will understand that we have a comprehensive look at the forest and view on the forest and what should or shouldn't be done on the national forest. So it certainly is not as simple as being a tree hugger, although we do like the fact that there are still tree huggers around. But that is certainly not a comprehensive or complete look at the forest. As far as website, yes, please go to our website. It's wildvirginia.org. We have our invasive plant project is on the website. You can view the report, which is 8 pages, has tables and maps about where these plants occurred. And there's also a short informational brochure about native or non-native plants in general. So all the information about the project is there, as well as information about the draft management plan for the National Forest, which I know we're going to talk about more. But that is sort of our number one priority at the moment, working on the draft management plan. So please go there for any information, including upcoming events. Something I forgot to mention is we hold monthly hikes. So we encourage people to get out into the National Forest, either on our monthly hikes or in any kind of way they can, to get to know the forest, to enjoy it. As I said earlier, people are part of the forest. We're not separate from the forest. So I hope people will get out and get to know the forest and enjoy it and want to become an advocate for protecting it in the process.
And that's next, is the uranium mining. And I want to tie that into another question that I have is, so Michelle talks, we had Mr. Jaffe on from Southern Environmental Law Center back in May, I believe, talking about uranium mining, something that I guess is wanted both in Orange County and then a little further down near the Danville area. George Washington National Forest. So let's tie this in with my question. Mining with potentially, I guess, our Virginia names are talking about doing this. What decisions do the state leaders make that may cause a problem with the federal decisions and wants and needs of Wild Virginia and others?
Yeah.
And let's start with the mining.
Yeah, the mining. Uranium mining, just real quickly, I'm not 100% sure of this, but I know that most of the uranium deposits are in Southside Virginia and then in other places, Orange County and other places around. So I do not believe uranium mining is a threat to the George Washington, but I don't want to make that as an absolute statement. So because of that, uranium mining is not something that Wild Virginia has paid a lot of attention to, again, as our focus is on the National Forest. As for your question, Rick, about state decisions, the state really does not have a large impact or influence on what happens on the national forests.
Not even with I guess, sort of what Wild Virginia might consider poor decisions in the conservation area?
The state agencies can make comments on the draft management plan. They can consult with and express their opinions to the Forest Service about the management plan and their activities, but they do not have rarely do they have a very direct influence in decisions. One exception to that is the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries, the Virginia Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. They are responsible for managing fish and wildlife across the state, so they often work with the Forest Service cooperatively, and they do have some influence about wildlife improvement projects, timber sales, and that sort of thing in the National Forest, but they don't control what happens. The U.S. Forest Service really controls what happens in the National Forest. We'll probably be talking about oil and gas leasing and minerals in the National Forest. That is controlled by the U.S. Forest Service in conjunction with the Bureau of Land Management. So the Forest Service, I know, would want to meet all the requirements of the various state agencies as they manage the land, in this case Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy. But again, it would be the decision by the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management about oil and gas leasing, hydrofracturing. I know that's a big topic that we're going to be talking about. So those are federal decisions and not really state decisions.
All right. We do have a caller on line four. Caller, hang on just a sec because I need to thank Dixon Disposal. Dixon wants to remind you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come. When Dixon's picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. Call them at 978-2111. Or internet use, DixonDisposal.com. All right, dial us up if you'd like, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. We are talking about conservation, a lot of work here on the George Washington National Forest with our guest David Hanna from the Charlottesville group Wild Virginia. All right. Dewey, where have you been?
I'm still here, Rick. I appreciate your your topic today.
Thanks. You got a question or a comment for David?
Both, I guess. Thank you, David, for the work you do, and we appreciate it. I think it was Michelle called and said something about the word a phrase, tree hugger. I think the original definition was from when industry went down to South America and the indigenous people couldn't speak our language. All they could do is grab a hold of the trees and say, no, we don't want you to cut these down. So I think that's where that word came from. It's similar to how the word redneck has gotten messed up. So I think that's a good word. And I remember the Tree Huggers Ball, and I never went to one, but do remember it. One thing I'm curious, got a bunch of things here. The Virginia Tech opened up a facility, I guess a campus, they announced it, I heard on the radio probably about 4 years ago, that school was geared, this school that was built and prepared, was geared to sell forest products from the state of Virginia internationally. And whatever happened with that school, David, it kind of was like hush-hushed. And another question, particularly the tsunami in Japan, is that a big impact on our forest products? And I'll get offline. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Dewey. Nice to hear from you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Dewey, and thanks for liking the tree hugger word. It is a good word. As far as the school that you talk about with Virginia Tech, I do not know if that school was ever formed or if there's still a push to produce wood products that can be sold internationally, if that's part of what Virginia Tech is doing at the moment. I do know that the forestry school there at Virginia Tech and at other forestry schools around the country, wood products is a big component of how they train their foresters or what they introduce their foresters to. As far as the tsunami as well, I do not really track forest products or forest goods coming out of the state or out of the U.S. In fact, the National Forest, George Washington and Jefferson National Forest, really contribute very little to the timber products statewide in Virginia. I think, I'm 99% sure this statement is accurate, that the two national forests combined have never contributed more than 2% of all the timber harvest coming out of the state of Virginia in any year since the forests have existed. So they are really a small component in terms of producing wood and timber statewide in Virginia. And I'm sorry, I really can't do more than that to answer your question. I don't really track the economics too closely of forest products internationally.
When we're talking about forest products, are we talking about, because the first image that went through my head was some sort of, the school forest product was something that I was going to sell or buy in a finished use. But I think what you and Dewey are talking about is a forest product being a log that's going to get turned into something else.
Yeah, and that is only one way to sort of look at products. We've talked about many, many uses of the national forest. So one product that the forest can provide is remote backcountry, areas where that are undisturbed and people can go for wilderness experiences, for science and recreation, for educational experiences. A place like the George Washington is the only place in Virginia, in our landscape, really, where that sort of experience can really be available to people. There's enough land that we can have large areas of undisturbed land and forest, much like the landscape used to be, pre-colonization. And so a lot of animals, a lot of natural communities occur in these areas that need that sort of habitat, that need that old forest, that large expanse of forest, in order to survive in the long term. So I would challenge us to think of products as more than just wood coming off the national forest. I've mentioned air quality, water quality. Those are social benefits. Those are social goods that we need to have our forests help create. So again, a product, it's not a wood product, but a product that the forest can produce. So I think we need to think much more broadly when we think about products and goods coming off the national forest. Well, a phrase that has come into vogue in recent years is ecosystem services. So that is clean air, clean water, view sheds, open space, wildlife habitat, things that a well-managed forest and even a lightly managed forest can provide at little cost to the public, but creates much, much public benefit.
11:35 here on the Wake Up Call. Thanks to Michelle and Dewey for their calls. You can call in as well with a comment or a question. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Our guest today, David Hanna. He's the conservation director from Wild Virginia, which is a nonprofit organization located here in Charlottesville. Let me give a moment and call for the Wake Up Call producer. We are looking for a Wake Up Call producer to join the team. The Wake Up Call is currently losing Kristen, who I believe is going away to college. Producer helps answer and screen phone calls and assists with some of the technical aspects of the show. No previous radio experience is needed. And it's a wonderful way for you to learn about radio and support the programming you enjoy. For more information or to apply, email wakeup@wnrn.org. All right. David, we need to get into the George Washington. What's the official name that they've come up with, the ways to, what to do over the next several years?
Every national forest has a land and resource management plan. So we just call it a forest plan for short. And the forest plans are very important because they do dictate what will happen on the forest for 10 to 15 years at a time. The current forest plan was finished in 1993, so here we are 18 years later under the plan that was finished then. In 2007, the George Washington staff began the process of creating a new plan for the George Washington that, due to some political and regulatory events over the last 4 years, that process has stopped two different times. So now we're in the third go-round with trying to create this forest plan. In May, a draft management plan was issued, and we and many, many other groups are invested in reviewing that plan and submitting comments on that plan. And one thing I encourage all of our members to do, and anybody who is interested, is to tell the Forest Service how you would like to see the George Washington managed. And if you can, to spend a little bit of time looking at the forest plan and reacting to the plan itself, giving some positive or negative feedback on the plan.
And they can get to that through wildvirginia.org. I'm sure you have a link to the plan itself.
That's right. We have links to the Forest Service website where the plan in all its, I don't know, 1,200 or 1,500 pages lives. So I do not expect people to go read the plan. That is more than a full-time job. But there are two short documents that are on our website as well as the Forest Service website. One is called Frequently Asked Questions. So that's 13 pages, I think. It gives a good overview of the new plan. And there's also a summary of the new plan and the environmental impact statement that accompanies it. That's 33 or 34 pages. But for someone who wants to do a little bit of work, those are two good documents to start with. And while Virginia is certainly going to be having information about our perspective on the plan on the website, comments are due September 1 on the draft plan. That is the deadline. So we have not posted all of our viewpoints and perspectives yet, but we plan to do that by early August. As you might imagine, it's taken me some time and our other people some time to review the plan. And honestly, not all the information about the plan is actually available yet. There's still some pieces of things, particularly about watersheds, that are not available yet that we haven't had been able to look at yet. So it's a lengthy process, can be very complex and trying, but we do hope people will take at least a little bit of time to tell the Forest Service what they think.
And we got some time left during the hour to go through some of the key spots. We got a caller, though. Laura, you still with me?
Yes, I am.
All right. Fire away. Question or comment for David?
First, I'd like to make a comment. I think I know about Wild Virginia, and I think you guys do really great things. I also had a question. It has to do a little bit with the fracking stuff. I hear that it has bad impacts on water and water quality, and I was wondering if you could comment on how, whether the water from the watershed in the National Forest affects any communities in Virginia, and if that's something, I think Wild Virginia did some kind of a study about water impacts on local communities, and if you could address that.
Thanks, Lori.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you, Laura. That's a great question. Yeah, I talked a little bit earlier about the drinking water study we did 2 years ago and all the communities that depend on the National Forest to supply water for the local drinking water supplies. Fracking. I know a lot of people have heard the term fracking, which is short for hydraulic fracturing. It's a technique that's been around since the 1940s and is used across the country to extract oil or natural gas from rock formations. It's become more common in the East, particularly in Pennsylvania, in the last decade or 20 years or so. It's a technique, hydraulic fracturing, by which, well, I should back up and say, there's a formation, a geologic formation called the Marcellus Shale Formation, which underlies much of Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, parts of New York, and parts of Western Virginia. This shale formation underlies about roughly half of the George Washington National Forest. So there are people who would like to see fracking occur in the National Forest. Fracking is a process by which you drill very deep into the surface, maybe a mile, sometimes deeper, vertically, then drill horizontally. And once you begin horizontal drilling, large amounts of fracking fluid and fresh water are pumped under intense pressure underground to fracture the shale, to fracture the rock. When that occurs, natural gas, methane, is released and then is captured at the surface. There are many, many potentially bad environmental impacts from this process. One is the fracking fluid itself. The fluids, the things that are used in the fluids, are considered proprietary. No one has to reveal what those substances are, but there's no doubt that many of them are toxic. There are things like formaldehyde, benzene. In the past, diesel fuel has been used to inject underground, under pressure to release the natural gas.
Stuff that I'm not allowed to just dump in the yard when I take it out of my car.
Exactly. Stuff you wouldn't even, you know, have access to ordinarily. So yeah, very, very, bad in my, I don't know what other words to use. I just think it's very, very inappropriate, that those substances do not have to be revealed to the public. So in fracking, once this injection of fluids is done, about a third or so of that comes back up to the surface. So it contains all of the original chemicals that were injected underground, plus in Pennsylvania and perhaps in Virginia as well, radioactive material which resides underground will be absorbed by the fluid and brought back up to the surface, as well as some really corrosive brines or salty chemicals. This backflow must be captured and isolated in lagoons, and there's no really good solution about what to do with this this backflow. One solution is to create another deep well and inject it underground, and people say it's injected so deep that it will not affect groundwater resources or aquifers. I think that's an open question. But some places, Pennsylvania in particular, want to ship this water to wastewater treatment plants, which are not really geared toward treating this kind of fluid. Our conventional sewage treatment plants are geared toward combating fungus or bacteria, I should say, sort of human waste and other things associated with that. They're not geared toward chemicals, synthetic chemicals or other things. So disposing of this water is a huge issue. And it, frankly, while Virginia believes it's not an appropriate use of the national forest lands, of public lands, to allow fracking on the national forest, the draft plan, one positive thing from the draft plan is they are proposing a ban on horizontal drilling in the national forest. And we support that. We think that is a very good step. It's actually kind of brave on their part. They are getting political pushback on that and a lot of pushback from the industry saying that ban is not correct, that they should not have a ban on it. But I would encourage everyone to applaud and support the Forest Service for that ban. And we, while Virginia is taking a further step and saying that we do not think oil and gas extraction on the national forest is an appropriate use, that no oil and gas exploration and extraction should be part of the draft plan.
All right, 11:45, our guest today, David Hanna, from Wild Virginia, which is a conversation. I did it again. I'm still under the single digits with that mistake. Conservation organization here in the Charlottesville area. We are talking about the George Washington National Forest. Let me take a moment, though, and thank Blue Ridge Graphics for their support of WNRN. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, as well as promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and brgtshirts.com.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
And let's see, it's been called the most complex residential garden landscape in all of Charlottesville. Chances are you've passed it by hundreds of times. But what happens to Rock Hill Garden when the Metacreek Parkway and 250 Interchange Project are completed? The Hook takes a look at the garden. With the NFL on lockout and the NBA expected to do the same, the sports doctor claims gambling is the real national sport. And The Hook presents the Restaurant Week Guide. The Hook. Pretty, fun, and tasty. And that's what it's all about. And let's take a moment and thank the backyard. UVA Corner's Culinary Secret at the end of Elliewood Avenue. The backyard has a seasonal menu, daily specials, and a rotating list of beers on tap. For more info, it's thebackyarduva.com. You can find them as well on Facebook. And Drew Thompson just walked in the studio. He'll be here at noon for Les Temps Perdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative music, like Lou Reed, World Party, and the Dead Milkmen, brought to you in part by Caliente. Requests are always welcome on Les Temps Perdue. All right, David, Lori got us going on the forest plan, and thank you, Lori, for your call. That's one of the things we chatted about at the very beginning of the program, which is people don't often think of the forest as the place for, I guess it's forest and park are often sort of interchanged. And so the forest, that's where you go to hike and bike and have a good time. But you're also going to, if approved, there won't be any fracking, but there's a possibility that you're going to be getting natural gas out of the forest. There's timber. And I think I copied this phrase from your website. How do you accommodate conflicting views of diverse users?
Well, that's the $64 million question. There's probably no plan that can be created that's going to make everybody happy, because there are many divergent views about how the forest should be managed. Fracking and just energy extraction in general is one contentious issue. But beyond that, wind energy has been proposed. More than half the forest will be open to the possibility of wind energy production, which is another contentious issue. Is that an appropriate use of the national forest? And what is the impact of that to endangered species?
I've never understood why wind turbines are contentious. I've never understood that. Can you tell me why Wild Virginia might have issues as against putting up a wind turbine?
Sure. Well, we are certainly all in favor of renewable energy, and wind is one tremendous resource that we should be tapping into. But we question whether the ridgelines of the Appalachian Mountains are an appropriate site for large industrial scale wind energy projects, because in the process of creating them, you have to destroy some forest, you have to remove some forest, and so the question becomes is that appropriate, because the forest obviously is going to store carbon, which is one way to offset climate change, is by storing carbon in trees. Also, if wind energy is a tool to combat climate change. These very forests, the ridgelines of the Appalachians, are precious resources over the long term for wildlife and animal and plant communities to be able to adapt to climate change. Species and communities are going to be, or it's going to be necessary for them to move north-south in reaction to climate change, but also up and down slope, elevational gradients. And so ridgelines, of course, are at the top of the mountains. So, and in the Appalachians, they are oriented on a southwest-northeast axis. So these are wonderful places. These are going to be necessary places in the long term for animals and plants to utilize for adaptation to climate change. So by putting industrial scale wind energy sites there, that option just goes away. Also, whether the wind in these spots is enough of a resource is also questionable. Certainly there's better wind, more reliable wind, stronger wind on the coastline of Virginia and really the whole Atlantic. And really the Midwest is the place where wind really exists as a tremendous resource. So for a lot of reasons, and not to mention the impacts to wildlife, they have not been fully studied yet. These turbines do cause mortality to birds and bats. And bats are really taking it on the chin right now. There's a fungus called white nose syndrome, which is decimating bat populations in the eastern United States. It is moving westward. No one knows how to combat this or mitigate this, and that is a huge threat to bat populations. So there are just a lot of reasons why wind energy is questionable on the national forest. Not to even bring up the sort of philosophical question about whether it's an appropriate use of public lands, that is, private development of public lands.
We also talked briefly about timber harvesting. What's acceptable timber harvesting? Because, I mean, you mentioned how the wind turbines, private use of public lands, is the timber harvesting not the same?
Well, there are private companies that bid on timber when timber sales are put up for auction. So it's similar, but I think different, because the timber is not a permanent sort of use of the land like the wind turbines would be. It isn't so much, you know, one of the issues about timber harvest is not only how much is done, but where it is done. And we think that there are special places in the national forest where timber harvest and other sorts of development just should not occur.
1 million acres, for those who weren't listening at the start of the hour, George Washington National Forest, 1 million acres.
That's right. And almost a quarter of that are in areas that are called inventoried roadless areas. So these are areas that were identified in 2001 as being basically roadless. That's a pretty descriptive term. Not completely roadless, but very, very few roads. And all of these areas are 5,000 acres in size or larger. So we think this quarter of a million acres is essential to remain protected. And the current draft plan does that. It says there's actually a 2001 roadless area rule which prevents further or prevents timber harvest or new roads in these roadless areas. So we applaud that. We think the plan should go a little bit further. The plan also identified 370 some thousand acres of what were labeled potential wilderness areas. I'm not very fond of that phrase or that term, but these are 370,000 or so acres that meet the requirements to be considered roadless. So we think those 370,000 acres should also be ruled or managed consistently with the roadless area rule, in that no new roads, no timber harvest. That still leaves, you know, two-thirds or so of the forest open for other types of management. And I'm not advocating that the rest of the forest should be open game for all sorts of activities, but I do think it's important to protect these special places, these roadless areas, potential wilderness areas and roadless areas, and also areas where rare species and rare communities have been documented. There's a phrase or a designation in the plan called special biological areas and key natural heritage communities. I would like to see all the areas that our state's Virginia or our Natural Heritage Program has identified as special, as home to some rare plants and communities. I think all those areas should be fully protected in the forest plan. So that in combination with protecting potential wilderness areas would go a long way toward preserving the special places and still allow other parts of the forest open to other types of management.
11:55 here on the Wake Up Call. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Our guest today, David Hanna from Wild Virginia, a conservation organization here in Charlottesville. Amazing the little things that you can do to trip over repeatedly. But you are here for conversation today.
Yes.
And so for the hour, you are the conversation director of Wild Virginia as well. David, Jefferson National Forest, smaller but similar to George Washington National Forest, underwent a similar plan in 2004. Changes or things that have proven to not be the best decision that you would like to be different in this upcoming plan?
That's a good question. Yeah, the Jefferson is similar. It's smaller in size. It's about slightly less than 600,000 acres, but they did complete a plan. I was not involved in forest planning at that time, so I don't know a lot of the and haven't really studied the plan that closely. One positive thing they did is identified drinking watersheds and have management prescriptions for drinking watersheds. The forest, the George Washington plan, does not have that. They have identified drinking watersheds, but they do not have management objectives for them specifically. They have also identified what they call priority watersheds, but that is some of the information that is lacking so far in the plan as to exactly what priority watersheds are, how they were identified. Some of the priority watersheds include drinking watersheds, but they don't include all the drinking watersheds. So we are still waiting for some information from the Forest Service about what these priority watersheds are. So anyway, the Jefferson sort of set a good tone and good example in that case, which the Forest Service did not use on the George Washington plan. But I would say the direction of the current plan, the draft plan, and again, I encourage people to submit comments to the Forest Service before September 1. I think the direction is a good one. They have for the first time identified and are setting aside two small areas of high-quality old-growth forest. I think there's some question about whether what they are protecting is large enough or not. I think the acreage is maybe not sufficient, but that's a positive step. Again, we mentioned fracking and the ban on horizontal drilling. That is a positive step. I hope that that will stay in place. And the special biological areas have increased in size in the draft plan from the current plan. Again, I'm not sure it is large enough that all the areas that should be special biological areas are identified yet, but it is a good direction. So I guess that would be my short take on the draft plan, that things are moving in a good direction. They are doing more with water quality protection. They actually increased riparian area protection, so that, again, is a positive thing. But there is more land in the forest that will be potentially available for timber harvest, potentially, and this is still to be determined, if there will be more acreage per year that is harvested. So there are a lot of details to be worked out. But there's no question they are sort of making a nod to some ecological realities.
Is 90 days enough? I mean, the plan came out in late May, and you have to have your comments in by September 1st.
That, you know, I certainly would wish for a longer time frame. If for us and others who have followed the process along, it's probably sufficient time. For someone who has not really been involved and is only now wanting to get involved and make some comments, it is really not enough time. It's insufficient. It's a very complex document, very lengthy document, hard to digest in many ways. It meets the legal requirements. 90 days is what NEPA calls for, so the Forest Service is certainly meeting all the legal requirements, but I and many others would long for a longer comment period.
All right, our guest today has been David Hanna from Wild Virginia. David, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Rick. It's been a pleasure to be here.
All right. Don't forget that you can send some questions or send your notes about the Wake Up Call producer to wakeup@wnrn.org. And you can also send me some suggestions about future topics or guests at wakeup@wnrn.org. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Don't forget, Les Temps-Perdue is next. Don't go anywhere.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.